in American Family Mutual versus DeWitt, and we're ready to hear from the petitioner.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Dwight Prinkle, and I'm appearing for American Family this morning. I intend to begin my remarks this morning by addressing the jury trial issue, and I will most likely focus the bulk of my argument on that unless the court's questions direct me elsewhere. In preparing for the argument this morning, I initially thought that there's an opportunity to make new law with this case. And as I reread the case law and the briefs and the authorities that have been decided by both parties, it became increasingly clear that the Court of Appeals simply misapplied the law or ignored the law in reaching the conclusion that it did in this case. There are a number of propositions that are relevant to this case, which are well settled, and it appears that the parties agree to. The first of these is the applicability of the common law test to resolve the issue of entitlement to a jury trial in a civil action. That test requires an examination of whether the action would have been venued in the law or chancery courts of England in 1607. There doesn't seem to be a dispute that that's how we decide this case. There also seems to be an agreement of the parties in this case, and there's really not much dispute in the case law or the treatises or other authorities that are cited in the briefs that an action by an insurer in subrogation derives from the common law equity courts. It is a remedy, it is a procedure that was developed by the equity courts, and that is determinative, and that is one area where we do agree with the Court of Appeals analysis, that they recognize that that subrogation is an equitable vehicle and an equitable claim under the common law. Another principle which should guide the court in this case, and again, there's not a dispute in the briefs, and there does not appear to be a significant dispute in the case law, is that the plaintiff determines by the pleadings, by the claims asserted, how the common law test should be applied. So if the plaintiff drafts the complaint or amends the complaint to assert an equitable claim, that is determinative of how the case must be tried.
And it's only a bench trial, right? I mean, is that...
Excuse me, Your Honor?
It's only a bench trial. It can only be a bench trial. I mean, what follows from that?
In most cases, it requires that it be a bench trial. There are perhaps some exceptions that are discussed in the case law, but none of them applies in this case. So in this case, particularly given the posture of the case immediately before trial, it could only be a bench trial, given the nature of the claim and the nature of the remedy the plaintiff was seeking. There is in the case law some degree of confusion in applying the common law test. And the source of the confusion or the basis of the confusion appears to be when examining the common law, do you focus on the nature of the claim and by analogy look at common law writs of the English common law, or do you focus on the nature of the remedy? So our position in this case, and I think it's one that makes sense and is borne out by the case law, is that you look to the remedy as opposed to examining the cause of action and trying to align that with some English writ of the 1600s. You simply focus on the remedy that the plaintiff is seeking. And I think support for that proposition is in the Continental Title case, Continental Title versus District Court from September 1982. In that teaches that the focus is on the remedy. More recently than that, and unfortunately, it was a case that was not cited in the briefs, but it reaffirms the Continental Title focus on remedy is the Peterson versus McMahon case from 2004. And in that case, the court actually expressed a preference for remedy-focused application of the common law test. Again, some of the cases talk about, well, you look at the underlying cause of action, and that's sort of at least a part of the test. But a remedy-focused analysis is a better approach, and indeed it appears to be the preferred approach expressed by this court for examining the jury trial issue, because it's something that lawyers and judges understand and can more easily apply. Everybody understands injunctions as being equitable relief. Everybody understands that when a plaintiff is seeking damages for pain and suffering or something along those lines, that is requesting an equity or a remedy at law. And those are distinctions that have force and vitality today.
Could I interrupt you one second?
Sure.
Given your characterization of Peterson as seeming to favor the remedy test, how do you explain its exploration and particularly look at the restatement and looking to see if this was an exception to whether the action would have been brought in equity or law in that case?
Again, you know, I think there's there was a huge other issue, as you know, I think, where you wrote the dissent in that case. That issue had to do with whether or not the trial court sitting as the finder of fact was authorized under our statutes to award exemplary damages. So to the extent that the court engaged in that sort of historical analysis, it may well have been focusing on that issue. But I think the case does clearly express a preference for just looking at the remedy. So to the extent that the court went beyond that, I can only assume that it was focused on the whole issue of exemplary
damages. You raised one other point for me here. Do you think that we would analyze the question differently depending on whether what's at issue is entitlement to a jury or whether what's at issue is exemplary damages?
I think there are other contexts where you have to look at the common law. So again, I think this is a determination that's probably made early on in the case or certainly before trial. You would want to do the analysis of the remedy under the common law. There might be other circumstances where you'd want to go beyond that, for example, with jury trial or with exemplary damages or other aspects.
But are you suggesting that we would look more at the remedy and less at how this action would have proceeded at common law, depending upon whether what's at issue is do you get a jury trial or should you get exemplary damages, or are those the exact same thing?
I couldn't rule out any scenario or circumstances where it might not be the same thing. But just for purposes of the question before the court, I think, yes, that's the bulk of the inquiry is what's the remedy? And as I say, that approach offers the advantage of ease of application. It's well understood. It's modern. It's current law. It doesn't require the historical analysis that if the court was a court wanted to really trace this back to the common law roots and understand what the common law writ would be, that's a complex and difficult inquiry.
And I didn't mean to derail you while you're on this point and you're moving in that direction. Then maybe you could explain how that favors your position in this case, if the remedy is what you look
at. Yes. It's clear that was the remedy that the plaintiff sought in this case was an equitable remedy. Now, the Court of Appeals focused on, you know, the fact that this sort of started out as an ordinary automobile negligence tort kind of case, or at least the original pleadings employed that language. And sort of as this case, I think, had a fairly long history prior to trial. But immediately prior to trial, you know, the focus of the case changed so that it was clearly equitable. And if you look at the actual motion to strike the jury that was filed shortly before the trial in this case, it's actually entitled Plaintiff's Motion to Strike Jury Trial and Have Court Sitting in Equity Determine Issues of Restitution, Reimbursement, Unjust Enrichment, and Family Car Doctrine. So at that point, any idea that the plaintiff was seeking non-equitable remedies or damages or something other than these specific remedies that they're requesting in the motion to strike the jury, I mean, that was settled at this point. So clearly the remedy that was being sought by the time the case went to trial was equitable.
And if I can just follow up there, it sounds like you're saying it's equitable because it was couched in terms of restitution or subrogation. It was asking for money, right?
Yeah, it was asking for money. But what money was it asking for? It was a liquidated sum that was exactly its out-of-pocket expenditure. It's the check that they had to write, or the combination of the two checks that the plaintiff had to write to its insured. It was a fixed sum, and at trial, that is all the plaintiff sought to recover. So that's a distinction, I think, that's important when addressing the issue of wasn't this really a case for damages. It wasn't. Had the insured sued directly, the defendants, the tortfeasors in this case, undoubtedly he would have sought damages that are more traditionally legal damages, pain and suffering, disfigurement, inconvenience, all those sort of exemplary damages, potentially. And the plaintiff in this case, consistent with the equitable posture that it took in this case, sought none of those damages. So by virtue of their motion, by virtue of their proof at trial, there's not much dispute that it was pursuing an equitable remedy in this case. And with a proper focus on the remedy, the case should not have been submitted to the jury. And back to your question, well, wasn't the plaintiff really seeking damages in the form of money in this case? No. And again, this...
excuse me, Mr. Pringle, what were the out-of-pocket expenses that you claim? What were they based upon?
This case, procedurally, there had been an arbitration between American Family and its insured between this case, or before this case. And what the outcome of that was the DeWitt had a $25,000 policy. The insured in this case thought that was inadequate and filed an underinsured motorist claim.
Yes.
And that is what went to arbitration. And in that arbitration, the arbitrator, in fact, determined that his losses were $200,000, but because the policy was only $100,000 for underinsured motorist coverage, that is what American Family paid. And that was their proof at trial. That's what they sought to recover at trial.
Was that $100,000 based on non-economic damages, in part?
Yes. That's, and that's, again, I think a finding that was made by the Court of Appeals, and I think that was correct. So there's a number of cases that talk about the fact that courts may order a party to pay money. Courts sitting in equity may order the payment of money without converting the case to one at law. And the well-known example is, and again, it's one discussed in the Continental title case and one in, that's discussed in the city of Colorado Springs versus Connor case. Oftentimes, equitable remedies will require or will necessitate a payment of money, and that does not mean that the court is awarding damages.
Could I ask one more question there?
Certainly.
That, let's take that as being the case, then how do we decide whether that's an equitable remedy? If it's not on the basis of money rather than an injunction, something like that, then unless it's by characterizing how that action would have proceeded at law or in equity, how do we decide that that remedy is equitable?
I mean, that's always going to be an issue in a money case. Is it equitable or is it an action at law? I think you have to look at what does the money represent? How was the sum calculated? Was it the plaintiff saying, I can't sleep nights, so I should get a certain sum in your judgment that ought to compensate me for that? That makes it easy to decide that that is a claim for damages. If you're dealing, and I'll give you the best analogy, is the back pay cases. And those involve a sum of money that are almost uniformly considered in the cases as equitable relief. And that's obviously based on what was the person making, what was the financial loss that they suffered as a result of whatever action was being challenged. So, and the court seemed to have no difficulty saying, yes, that's an equitable remedy. So there are probably existing tools in the law that the courts can apply or can look at to decide if a request for money is an equitable claim or a legal claim.
So in this particular case, what are you saying we should look at? We should look at the insurance companies wanting to be made whole, or we should look at what the insurance company had to pay?
Well,
in terms of characterizing it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's by coincidence or not, but I think they're the same thing in this case. What the plaintiff sought was to be made whole, which is what they had to write the check for. So I think if you view it from the perspective that all the plaintiffs sought in this case, and it is all that they sought, was to be made whole.
Well, you're confusing me with the words. Who are you saying is the plaintiff? Is that the insurance company?
Yes.
Okay. So what you're saying is that should control, that the insurance company wants to be made whole for having to pay out the policy limits?
Yes, that.
And it would not matter what the underlying claim was based on?
No, because I don't know that was anything that necessarily was subject to relitigation in this case. And I don't think.
I just want you to elaborate and give me some ability to understand why we would cut it off at that level and say we will look only at what the insurance company is asking for. We won't look at what the insured was asking for in the arbitration.
Well, okay. You look at what did the insurance company do in this case? What they didn't do was try and pump up the damages by adding some sort of derivative claim for pain and suffering or something that, that the insured might have sought had he been the plaintiff. So I think there was a conscious attempt by the plaintiff insurance company to simply stop at getting its money back. And there was a claim for interest in addition to that, but I don't think that by itself would change the character of the relief that was being sought. So
your argument, I think, is that this would be analogous to the civil rights payments that are characterized as equitable relief because they are making the plaintiff whole?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And that's a fixed sum, in the employment case as determined by what the plaintiff's rate of pay was, how long he or she was out of work. By analogy, we're talking about a fixed sum in this case, and a very easy to determine fixed sum. They look at the amount of the checks they had to write. So that that establishes that it was purely equitable, both the underlying nature of the claim, i.e. subrogation, and the relief sought, simply restitution or being made whole.
Would a contract claim then for liquidated damages? Are you suggesting that would be an equitable remedy?
There's a little bit of a problem with that hypothetical in that Rule 38 specifically says in an action on a contract, there is a right to jury trial. You know, as an academic exercise, perhaps that argument could be made if Rule 38 didn't specifically say you have a right to a jury trial in a contract case. But you could say it's a liquidated sum. It's a fixed sum. Everybody can agree on the sum, so therefore it's equitable. Perhaps. I don't know, and I wouldn't want to venture an opinion given what Rule 38 says explicitly. I'd like to move on to the second issue in the case, and that is the attorney testimony.
Before you move on, counsel,
sure.
Down here on the end, could you just briefly address the alternative kind of ground that there were existing fact issues?
Yes, I'd be happy to address that.
Briefly.
Yes. There are sort of unresolved factual issue, or the primary factual issue, and the one the Court of Appeals focused on, was this whole question of the family car doctrine. It's important to remember in this case, you know, it's a critical aspect of this case, is that the whole the question of negligence was admitted. So, you know, the central basis for impaneling a jury no longer was in the case once negligence was out. You still have the issue of family car doctrine and residence and some factual issues that were related to the application of that. Our position is that, you know, just because there are some secondary or extraneous factual issues that the court sitting in equity will have to decide, that doesn't change the basic character of the case. So the trial court sitting in equity, there's no reason why it couldn't have decided that issue and why that sole factual issue necessitated a jury.
So I guess your position is you don't get a jury on all factual issues. There's kind of a preliminary step in the inquiry, which is, do you get a jury or not? And then if you don't, who cares if there are factual issues? Is that kind of what you're arguing?
Well, I think, yeah.
Okay.
But, I mean, you don't even have to go that far in this case because the main factual issue wasn't at play. But, yes, I think, you know, yes, that's how you would decide. First, you have to decide, is there a right to a jury trial or not? And then if you decide there is not a right to jury trial, then the court decides all issues of fact, whether or not they're the primary issues of fact or secondary issues of fact. So, you know, I'm aware of no principle that says that trial court sitting in equity can't decide disputed facts. I don't think Rule 38 says that, doesn't require that. So, no. The trial court in this case was well within its jurisdiction to have decided that factual issue. Quickly again to address the issue of attorney testimony, I rely heavily on the Stone versus Satriana case. Again, it's factually, it doesn't look like this case in particular. You know, the issue, the factual aspects of that case were quite a bit different. What I think that case does establish is that sort of using a party's attorney to gain some kind of a tactical advantage or inserting them into the litigation in some way is something that needs to be looked at very, very carefully and with a very doubtful eye. There's a number
Pringle?
Of scenarios that I've suggested.
Mr. Pringle?
Yes.
Can I just ask you a question that I'm not clear about? The Court of Appeals opinion didn't consider the objection that you made, and they ruled that the relevancy objection under 401 did not include the 403 prejudice.
Yeah, that's
so
correct.
How does your second issue relate, or does it relate in any way to the issue you just argued about? Somehow or other, the question itself impacts or our concern about that we expressed in Stone versus Satriani.
Okay. I think you're asking me, was this issue preserved properly at trial? And obviously, the Court of Appeals said no, and
yes.
Obviously...
What's your position? Okay.
You know, they said the right objection was not made at trial. No doubt about it. Our position is that there are those issues that the court may notice on its own, or there are some issues that are deemed sufficiently grave or important that the court may review them even if there was no objection made at trial. Here, there was a rather long-winded objection made. There's two or three pages of discussion, argument with the court and the attorneys related to the objection. Rule 403 was never mentioned. The balancing test was never mentioned. Nonetheless, it's our position that because of the concern that the court has expressed about making attorneys pawns in the litigation or somehow manipulating the attorney-client relationship to gain an advantage is something that is highly detrimental to the system, that this is something we would ask the court to consider notwithstanding.
What about, I think the point was made by Mr. Nuss at trial. You had evidence of an $80,000 offer and that opened the door to whatever your attorney might have said in an unprivileged situation. How would you respond to that?
You know, I think the defendant's point in calling the attorney was to establish that, hey, they took the position and the arbitration in this case was only worth $7,500. I don't think they needed to call their former attorney to establish that point. I think as a part of the plaintiff's case in chief in this case, they called the adjuster from the insurance company that handled the case. They very well could have established, you know, here's what the payout was, you know, here's the position that a carrier took in the arbitration. You don't need to call the former attorney to do that. And, you know, it's hard to escape the conclusion that the purpose in calling the attorney was to establish for the jury that the insurance company was sort of being duplicitous.
How did you put in evidence of your $80,000 offer?
I didn't try the case,
I don't recall
the record that was in evidence. So if
you don't recall that?
I don't recall that from the record. I do recall the testimony of the adjuster that basically said, here's how we ended up paying $100,000. So, and if that's in the record and I'm not aware of it, I apologize for that.
Mr. Pridlo, I have a simple question to clarify the context in which this argument occurs. That is, to the extent that you're saying, regardless of whether the 403 was preserved or not, we still need to consider these important considerations that you say come from Stone versus Satriana. Is the context of that nonetheless 403? I mean, are what you're saying is that even if we don't think it was preserved, this is still an argument about unfair prejudice?
I think it goes beyond 403. And I think it's...
What is it then, if it's not unfair prejudice?
It is a case about the integrity of the judicial system. And that's kind of the subtext that I read.
So what's the objection to the evidence? I mean, if the right objection had been made, what is it? That as a matter of policy, this shouldn't be permitted?
That would be my argument. I don't think lawyers should be made witnesses in cases absent some extremely extraordinary reason or circumstances which weren't present in this case.
Isn't what a lawyer says in open court a party admission?
Yes, but the lawyer isn't testifying under oath. The lawyer, when he or she makes a representation in court, they're not subject to cross-examination. And this is different. When the lawyer is a witness, it opens up all sorts of problems. I think it impinges upon a party's choice of counsel. It, I think, affects the lawyer's judgment, not only being called as a witness, but the prospect of being called as a witness. If a lawyer has to consider, well, if I make this argument or I take this position, I may have to explain it later on the witness stand. I may be called as a witness in another case or a related case.
Well, you may or may not have to explain it, but it would be, when you say something on behalf of a client, I always thought it was an admission of fact that could be used against your client if you say it in the courtroom. As an attorney, you're an agent of that client. Isn't that right?
But when an attorney makes a representation in open court, they're not subject to cross-examination. So I don't think, this is a very significant distinction between a lawyer making a representation in open court and a lawyer testifying about a position that was taken in court. And they're two different things.
Completely. Well, I guess I think you're right. I was under the impression, maybe it's incorrect, that although the lawyer was asked and all that was said was we thought the thing was worth $7,500. Is that wrong?
That is correct. My time is up. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Craig Ness, registration number 17935, and I'm here on behalf of the respondents, Edward DeWitt and his daughter, Sarah DeWitt. They were the defendants in the underlying trial, which I tried on their behalf. I first want to address the jury trial issue, since that was the first issue addressed by the petitioner. In this case, the petitioner is asking this court to make a drastic change in civil litigation in Colorado. I've handled many cases of subrogation over the years on both sides of the fence. I have several sitting on my desk right now. Subrogation claims relating to payments under uninsured motorist claims or fire damage to a house or construction defect action. In all those cases, except for this one particular office, the subrogor or plaintiff actually has asked for the jury, and the defendants have asked for a jury. What petitioner wants this court to do is take away the right of individuals and corporations in these type of subrogation actions to have a jury that's permitted and granted under Rule 38. Two district court judges, Judge Tidball, who did the briefs or motions in this case, Judge Plotz, who heard the trial, and then a panel of the Court of Appeals, found that this is the case in which the defendants are entitled to a jury. The decision of those courts was correct and should be upheld. There's no dispute that in the complaint filed by the plaintiff fixes the nature of the case. If you look under Rule 8 of the Civil Procedures, it states that a party must plead causes of relief that show that the pleader is entitled to relief, to give the court a sense of what the case is about and what the issues are. There is no claim for relief for equitable subrogation. Had American Family filed only a lawsuit saying equitable subrogation, it likely would have been dismissed under Rule 12. Subrogation, as we know, and on page 7 of the petitioner's brief, talks about this whole concept of stepping in the shoes. The insurance company steps in the shoes of the insured and takes the claim. In this case, it was a written assignment of the claim. It doesn't change the nature of the claims. It just changes the beneficial ownership of the claims. And then once that transfer has been made to the subrogor brings the lawsuit, the claims for relief, based on what the nature of the case is. A car accident could be negligence. A construction defect subrogation could be breach of contract, breach of express warranty. It could be premises liability. It could be products liability. I think what's being confused here by the petitioner is this whole concept of equitable subrogation is between the insurance company and its insured, then to take their claim and go after a third party they think is at fault. And that's where it stops. There's no equitable relationship between American Family and the DeWitts. And that's why if you look at the complaint filed by American Family in this case and the amended complaint, there always was only two causes of action. One for negligence against Sarah DeWitt and one for negligence or vicarious liability under the family car doctrine against her father. There was never a cause of relief for subrogation or reimbursement or restitution.
How do you mean there was never a cause of relief? Weren't you just saying that's how the case was pled, or did I misunderstand?
No, it was pled as a negligence and family car doctrine case. There's only two claims for relief. Because that is what Jeffrey Henderson, the state farm, or the American Family insured, had. Those were his claims against the DeWitts. Had he sued them directly for the accident, he would have sued for negligence and family car doctrine. He then assigned his claims to the insurance company, and they brought those same claims, negligence and family car doctrine.
I thought I understood Mr. Pringle to say that negligence was admitted by the time this case got to trial.
It was, with respect to Sarah DeWitt. And I don't think that changes the nature of whether it's equitable or legal. First of all, under a negligence claim, as you know, under negligence, they first have to prove someone's at fault, injuries, damages, and losses, and then cause, that someone caused these injuries, damages, and losses. The only thing that was admitted was the negligence for causing the accident.
So what was litigated?
What was litigated, in fact, was the issue of causation. Plaintiff in their case called Mr. Henderson to testify about his pain and suffering, his economic loss, his medical expenses. They called the treating doctor to talk about the treatment and the alleged injuries. It was presented just as a car accident lawsuit, except you had a different party sitting there as the plaintiff.
And how did they justify the other party? Was there nothing in the pleadings to suggest that the theory required that allowed them to pursue this claim was one in the nature of subrogation or restitution, whatever, however they characterize it, or did they just presume that they were an appropriate party to bring a negligence action?
Are you referring to in the actual complaint?
Or whatever in the trial. The pleadings that set up the...
I mean, first of all, in the complaint, it laid out those facts and the general allegations that Mr. Henderson had an accident, had insurance with American Family, they paid a certain amount, and then he assigned his claims. And then they went into the two causes of action. And that was the same information given to the jury.
And that he assigned his claims.
Correct.
Your opposing counsel said there wasn't any dispute that the nature of this action, he called it subrogation, would have proceeded in courts of chancery, you know, before our statutes, that this would have been historically an equitable action. Is that true? Are you admitting that this?
No, I don't think it was historically. I mean, the concept of being able to take someone's claim like that and bring it against another party is an equity, but I don't think it changes the nature of the claims that you bring against the third parties to prove your case. And that's why in this case they had to prove the other elements of causation, damages. They had to prove the elements of family car doctrine. And all the cases that were cited in the briefs talk about clearly equitable claims. The beneficiary against the trustee, or the Continental case dealing with civil rights, which is statutory, and the statute says inequity, or claims for rescission of a contract, or something like that, where the actual claim is an equitable claim. Here, the claims were not against the DeWitts. They were legal claims. And if you look at the one case that petitioners cited in their reply from Indiana, the Valdez versus Capital Enterprise Insurance, that case is exactly on point. The facts of that case are exactly on point. It was a car accident. The carrier paid uninsured motorist benefits. They took an assignment of the claim and sued the at-fault driver. And the trial court in that case struck the jury, and the Court of Appeals said, no, this is a legal claim. The defendant has a right to a jury, and remanded it back for a jury trial. Just because American Family steps into the shoes of its insured, it doesn't strip the defendants like the DeWitts of their right to defend against the allegations being brought against them and have this decided by a jury. If you look at the Peterson-McMahon case, which talks about the remedy, which the court prefers, there it says the basic structure is if it's money involved, it's legal. If the parties are asking the court to use their coercive powers, for example, with injunction or something like that, it's equitable. And here...
But that didn't resolve the issue in McMahon, right?
No, it didn't. And that's because McMahon sort of mixed there was a mixture of claims in that case. I think McMahon dealt with a declaratory judgment action on an estate, and then there were other legal claims.
But at least with regard to trust, and maybe you're saying this is unique to trust situations.
Yes.
But at least there, didn't we feel the need to then go on and determine whether this particular kind of claim, even though it involved money damages, would have proceeded in law or in equity?
At one time.
Back in common law days?
Yes. But I don't think there are any cases that say that this type of equity or this type of subrogation would have been an equity court decision. I mean, equity permits it to go forward, but as they said in the Valdez case, the actual, when you look at the totality of the pleadings and the character of the relief sought, there was a negligence case, that case in Indiana. And there's no dispute that in this case they were seeking monetary damages. Monetary damages based on Mr. Henderson's claimed injuries and pain and suffering from the accident. And that's why at the trial, American Family put on the same type of case they would have had Mr. Henderson been the.
Is it true, though, that they were not seeking damages in the amount of the damages caused by the negligence, but rather for the amount they had paid out?
Correct. But the DeWitts were not a party to that arbitration. The amount they paid out was not binding on the DeWitts. They still had to prove, as against them, causation and damages.
But I took it your opponent's argument was, so these were not damages for negligence that they were seeking. They were seeking to recover the amount they had paid out, which was in the nature of subrogation or restitution.
I mean, at the trial, they said, yes, we paid this figure out. They talked about being in the shoes of the insured, and then they talked about the basis for the arbitrator's award, and that's when they presented the evidence of Mr. Henderson, who testified just like a plaintiff would in a personal injury case, and they had the doctors testify. I had a doctor testify. So they had to show what the basis of the claims were. Because again, that's what Mr. Henderson would have to prove if he sued the DeWitts directly. And that $100,000 payment was not binding on the DeWitts. I think to take away the right of a jury in a subrogation action would be manifestly unjust to the DeWitts or to any defendants in a case like this. You know, I think there's some belief that subrogation actions are basically battles between insurance companies transferring money. But that is not always the case. In this case, the DeWitts had a $25,000 policy as required by Colorado law. They were not breaking Colorado law. And then they're sued through this action by American Family asking for $75,000 of their own money for negligence and family car doctrine. They have the right to have those decisions made by a jury. And again, if you look at the Valdez case from Indiana, the facts are exactly on, and the issue was it might have started out as equitable historically, but when it comes to this particular case, how it has to be proven becomes a negligence case, and it's in law, and there should be a jury. Before I go on to the next issue with the testimony of the attorney, any more questions on the issues related to the jury?
Yes, I have one more for you.
Yes, sir.
American Family have requested the full amount of damages and been awarded it in this under this fact scenario?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Can you repeat that for me?
Well, as I understand, American Family only sought the amount they paid out, the $100,000.
Correct.
And let's say the claimed damages were $200,000. I can't remember what they were, but more anyway. Could they have sought and been awarded the full amount of damages that Henderson claimed? Or were they limited to the $100,000?
I think they were limited because of the transfer of Mr. Henderson's claims to American Family. Mr. Henderson only received $100,000. That's all he could receive under the policy. So when he transferred his claims against the DeWitts to American Family, that was the amount that was transferred.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And just to follow up on that, I assume then it doubly goes that even if factually this had been a case that might have justified it, that the insurance company, you wouldn't be saying the insurance company would be in a position to ask for exemplary damages against your client?
Correct.
Even though it is a matter that would require a jury trial,
Oh, I mean, if American Flag would have sought exemplary damages?
Yeah. I guess what I'm saying is the ruling you're seeking one that would say that someone in the position of the insurance company, even though only proceeding by assignment, could seek exemplary damages if his S&E could have sought exemplary damages?
I don't think it'd be, I think they probably could do that, whatever claims are assigned to them. And then a court of law would have to decide if there's a valid basis for that. On the issue of the testimony of the American Family attorney, at the trial, petitioner had three objections, one on relevancy only, 401, qualifications of the attorney as an expert, and then that the testimony would invade the province of the jury. Now, only here in front of the Supreme Court has the petitioner raised this issue of apparently, I guess, a fundamental right that was violated. I want to talk about each of those briefly. First of all, the relevancy issue, there was no 403 objection anytime during that objection, and it was a long objection at the bench that was recorded. The Court of Appeals was correct in finding, with a majority of opinions, that a 401 objection does not encompass a 403 objection.
Mr. Knotts, let me ask you a question about
that. Yes.
You know, 403 and prejudice were not mentioned, but a lot was said, such as that would prove the damages, I think, were squat, is what was said.
Yeah.
So it was an unreliable opinion, and it was merely, you know, puffery, a lawyer's advocacy, etc., and it would invade the province of the jury. That sounds kind of like what I consider to be prejudice, that the lawyer saying something would prove too much, basically. I wonder how you might address that.
I guess it's the interpretation of those comments. I interpret it as it's still relevant. What's the relevancy? I mean, that was what I think the focus of his argument was, that why is she here? There's no relevancy.
Well, he also said at the end, after he kind of lost, he said, well, it's an admission, which would seem to be conceding the relevancy.
Right. And then it just goes back to the fact that the trial court then has to do that balancing test and decide if it is prejudicial or not, which the court then typically defers to the trial court unless there's abuse of discretion. Even if there had been a 403 objection, I don't think there was ever abuse of discretion. If you're saying, well, they're being technical, the Court of Appeals, let's look at, so it was a 403 objection. I think that there was no abuse of discretion because Mr. Henderson testified in direct. Mr. Moore asked him a couple questions about at the arbitration, for example. How much did your attorney ask the arbitrators to award in this case? He said $1 million. And I asked, how much did the arbitrator give you? He said $300. He was wrong. It was actually $200. Then Mr. Brown testified and talked about an offer being made of $80,000 during the arbitration. I asked Mr. Henderson, well, how much did American Family then state in the arbitration the value of your case? And he couldn't remember. So I tried to get that evidence in through other witnesses.
Mr. Brown was the adjuster?
Yes, and Mr. Henderson was the insured. But Mr. Brown was not at the arbitration, so he couldn't answer that question. And Mr. Henderson said he couldn't recall. So my thought was that American Family was trying to get this evidence in of $1 million demand to show that, oh, the case was probably worth $1 million. We're lucky it's only $100,000, so jury, it's not a big deal if you award this against the DeWitts. And I wanted to show through the attorney that there actually had been a statement at the arbitration of $7,500. And if you look at my direct examination of the attorney, it only lasted, I think it was maybe five questions. You were there, what did you ask for? And it was basically brought in to rebut information they brought in through other witnesses. They opened the door, and I needed to address it. So if you look at a 403 analysis, I don't think it was prejudicial in any way. The other objection was qualifications as an expert. I didn't present her as an expert. She wasn't qualified by the court as an expert. It was simply a fact witness. And the invasion of the province of the jury, I don't think that was ever articulated why that was an objection. The issue raised now, apparently this fundamental right or attorney-client privilege, you know, there's long established law in Colorado that the court will only consider questions raised at the trial level, and it was never raised at any time, and it wasn't even raised with the Court of Appeals. The Stone case has no bearing on this case. That dealt with a non-party designation where they did that to try to get the other attorney disqualified as a non-party. And then petitioner talks about, well, under 1390.107, privileged information was disclosed. Well, that's not true. She was never asked anything about privileged communications with the client. She was only asked about statements she made in open forum and arbitration, where the arbitrator was there, Mr. Henderson, Mr. Henderson's attorney. And then petitioner says, well, she shouldn't have testified because there was a risk of prejudicial information or attorney-client information coming in. Anytime you have a witness testify, there's that risk. A defendant or plaintiff might say something that was privileged. In a car accident case, a defendant or plaintiff might mention insurance, or they might mention the traffic ticket. There's always the risk of something coming in that shouldn't. If that's the basis for reversing a case because there was a risk of something coming in, then there wouldn't be any witnesses to testify in a case. Petitioner is asking this court to reverse the judgment based on a hypothetical that it might have been a communication that was privileged. It never occurred. Again, as I said, the trial court has broad discretion in admissibility of evidence, and there has to be an abuse of discretion, which is manifestly arbitrary, reasonable, or unfair. In this record, there's no evidence of an abuse of discretion. So on behalf of Edward and Sarah DeWitt, I ask that the judgment of the trial court and the judgment of the Court of Appeals be upheld in the favor of the DeWitts. Petitioner had their day in court, as did the DeWitts, and the jury made their decision, and there's no basis under this record or in the law for this case to have to be retried. Thank you for your time.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. Case stands submitted. The court.